Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Screenwriters Rewatch, and we're continuing our journey through IMDb's top 250 film list. In this episode, Alex and I are talking about the film Double Indemnity, and later we'll decide whether or not it deserves its place in film history and in the script department vaults hidden in the backseat of the Deke Rickson's family car. If you've joined us from our YouTube review, welcome back. And if you haven't, I really insist that you go over and check out Alex's review, as it's film noir at its best. I hadn't actually watched this before, Alex, so seeing this was a real pleasure for me to really understand the, you know, sort of the godfather, as it were, of film noir. But like, you've been in sort of head down in this genre for a while, haven't you? You're quite passionate about it.
I do enjoy a good noir. And I think, like most people's, my first would have been Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yes.
It's a classic noir tale. You've got your PI drawn into a world of seniors and lies and secrets, and it all culminates to a citywide sort of conspiracy, which a lot of them sort of fall into. Chinatown falls into a similar thing. The Third Man has a sort of a whole selling medicine that's watered down sort of thing. You know, there's sort of these big wider issues that the protagonist finds themselves sort of uncovering when they're searching for something else, and that's become a lot of this one, which is what makes Double Indemnity actually quite interesting within the noir world, is that it's not somebody sort of uncovering lies and secrets to a bigger problem. It's actually from them creating the problem. Mm.
That's it. He's revealing those lies and secrets.
Yeah. Mm. Exactly. It's almost like we're the detective along that ride. You know, he does the talk to his partner Keys throughout the film, and we are sort of put into that part of Keys to an extent, but yeah, that's what makes, I thought, what makes this one slightly more interesting than some of the others. That, you know, Maltese Falcon is very similar, Third Man, Chinatown, all of those sort of have this very same plot base, where this one is obviously that little bit more different.
Mm. And it's good that you've brought up Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because that was a comparison that I had for this film, only really in the sense that I felt that Phyllis and Jessica Rabbit shared an awful lot of traits, not least just in their behaviours and their mannerisms, which is classic film noir to have that femme fatale character in there manipulating the protagonist throughout. But I also picked up some of the physical gestures that Phyllis had with her doughy-eyed expressions and the way she delivers her lines. And it just hit me between the eyes that those two characters feel like the same person, even though, of course, Jessica Rabbit is not real. Well, probably about as real as Phyllis is, but yeah. But I mean, she is, Phyllis is a classic femme fatale, and she is initially, she portrays a very interesting character. And something that I love about film noir is how it tends to reflect the sort of the social standing at the time. And this is, you know, 1944, we're coming to the end of World War II. We're starting to see some very big societal changes, not least in the way that gender roles are depicted. And for Phyllis, we meet her and she is this housewife, but there's something about her. She's in, you know, she's not swooning at, you know, Walter's interest. She's really affronted by it. And she kind of really calls him out for his, like, would you talk to my husband like that if he was here? And, you know, she's very conniving. You can see her brain processing working. And you think for a little while that Walter's going to get one over on her, but he doesn't. The other way around, sorry, that, you know, he's going to be sucked in by her, but he doesn't actually. And that really leans into the reluctant protagonist. How did you feel about the way that Walter and Phyllis first interact at the beginning?
I thought it was funny because you could almost watch it. There's two different scenes happening at the same time. Like, Walter is a very overbearing, misogynistic man. Which is funny because it's his tale. So you think he would be, because we're coming through his narration, you think he'd almost be kinder to himself. And she's played, if you watch the scene through him, she plays as a very downtrodden, needs to be rescued woman. And that's how he's sort of brought into the story. You know, like, he feels that he has to, you know, he's the better man for her because he can give her a little bit more excitement than her husband.
That's it. He's the white knight that's going to save her from this gilded cage. Yeah.
Exactly. But if you watch it from her point of view, you can see that she's already planning. And actually, he's a bit of a schmuck, sort of, you know, and he's not the brightest. He's not the thing. Even the words that he uses, he calls as her baby. He's very derogatory to her, which makes her very much an object to him, which I think is quite interesting. Like, just his use of language really denotes how he sees her. Where she's far more clinical is probably best one way to say it. It's like her dialogue comes across quite normal. Even that dialogue back and forth about that he's going too fast and he should give him a speeding ticket, you know, and even that, she's very, you know, she's the cop in that situation.
Yeah. She's got all the power, hasn't she?
Yes. Yeah. And he's sort of, he plays the what would be the woman role. If you were to take that scene into an actual police, that scene would normally be a male police officer and a female woman sort of flirting her way out. But they reverse the roles, which I think is really interesting. It's like he plays quite an effeminate, I mean, I say effeminate as in effeminate for 1944.
Yeah.
Than now. You know, he plays the female aspect of those roles, which I thought was quite an interesting take, that it really sort of confronts the masculinity of these people. Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting sort of takeaway just from their characters, that he plays that sort of always one step behind, sort of he's not the guy in charge ever, until you can possibly say the end when he actually puts it all together.
Yeah, and I think just as much as Walter is challenging, you know, his gender roles, Phyllis is really challenging the typical female roles. And I think something that, you know, as we're talking, realizing that her husband also treats her in the same way. So, you know, when you think about how she's either got incredibly terrible taste in men, or she knows how to handle this type of man and get what she needs from both of them. And she's failing to get what she needs from her husband anymore. So now she needs an escape plan and is utilizing the same type of man, being able to manipulate him, just like she may or may not, it's been very heavily inferred, manipulated her husband. So she is the ultimate femme fatale in this genre and in this film. And she portrays it incredibly well. And there's kind of almost like a triple bluff, isn't there? Because you don't know whether she killed the ex, the dead wife. You don't know that she actually wants to be with Walter. And you don't know whether or not she really is with Zucchetti in the end. It's kind of all inferred. And I think depending on whether you empathise with Phyllis in her situation, depends on how much of that you're willing to believe. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that she was as cold and as callous as all that? Or do you think she was a survivor making the best of things? Or what's your take on Phyllis's motives?
I would like to think it's I think if you had a really in-depth backstory to her, I think you would have her starting off as a survivor. I think she would come across, she would have been some sort of, and it's speculating, some sort of bad childhood, escaped, had to do things to sort of keep within a sort of mean. So I can see her bouncing from man to man. And initially, I believe that she probably had that. But I think as the years have progressed, I think she's come quite cold. And I think she probably was using several men at once. Like, we have the thing with Nino, you know, the Zucchetti, as the sort of other man who may have actually turned up to do this job. But it just happened to be that Walter was a better way out. And I think she shut off to her life. And I think that's why at the end, when she starts having those revelations with him about loving, like she never really loved somebody and things like that. And I think she starts to come to realize how she has manipulated people and what it's meant for her. And I think she shut herself off, and now she's sort of having to deal with those consequences of being that sort of person. And I think that shows at the end. You know, she said, you know, she couldn't until a minute ago. When I couldn't find, you know, she couldn't find love until she realized she shot him once, and she couldn't shoot again. Like she was gonna go through with it, but then she shot him, and she was like, "Actually, I don't know if I want him to die." But at that point, the consequences of her actions have already gone too far, and it he has no other option but to. I mean, in nowadays you would possibly find other ways around. I think storytelling comes a bit further, but obviously at that point it's like, well, we just got you know, people have to pay for their actions, and that her punishment must be death. Even Walter, like, you come to understand why he does it, but you still need, you know, they still have him die because he still needs to hit those consequences. But yeah, so I think she doesn't realize how far or how cold she's become until it all sort of comes to an end.
And it's interesting what you say about that sort of retribution aspect to the ending, because she's also already referred to in one of those opening scenes that she has with Walter, that to be put in prison would be a freedom that she would consider a luxury. So for the audience to then sort of see her being arrested, she's effectively getting away with it because she's still free from the tyranny of the life that she was living, even though it's still in another type of prison. So I think you're right. I think that death is the ultimate retribution for her, because there is no escape. There's no, you know, she can't find any solace in that. And I found the last moments where just before she was shot, that revelation that she had about not being capable of love, I found that really quite a deep and meaningful part of her character arc. And I was really surprised to see that level of intimacy, that sort of psychological intimacy, emotional intimacy, from a woman in a 1940s film. And I felt very challenged by my own perception of what films and stories are from that era. So it was quite an eye opener, actually, to sort of see a female portrayed in such a way. And I'm, you know, even though she was a villain, I think a modern woman would relate a lot to how she thinks and behaves, obviously not the killing part, but I think there was quite a lot of modern values in her approach towards survival, tackling men who disrespected her. And so I think quite a lot of that of her character could translate right through to 2023.
Yeah, and I think if you did this film in a more modern setting, I think you would have Neff turn her over to the cops. I think you would have her getting some sort of freedom. Like you said, like, even, you know, being in prison is a type of freedom away from that world. And I think if you had that film now, you would have more of a sympathetic arc for her, instead of just having you have the audience sort of arc that we would come to her to appreciate and want her to be free is just as much as everyone else, but she needs that sort of piece to go along with it.
Yes. I think it's because she is built as part of a structure for a genre, which, you know, this film came before it became an actual, you know, sort of structured genre, but it has sort of fallen that way. And I think something that I sort of in my research about film noir and thinking about how the protagonist is usually manipulated and they're quite passive in that sense, and you find that the femme fatale there, or the antagonist, is what is that driving force for their their inversion, their dark inversion. So they're quite helpless to what is going on around them. But I still wondered, you know, because this is one of the early examples of film noir, and maybe it's been refined since, but I still felt there were several moments where Walter doesn't actually, there's not enough of a reason for him to have made the choices that he made or found himself in the situations that he did. So where Phyllis reveals the plan, or he works out the plan, I say that with inverted commas, he works out her plan and says, no, I'm not going to do that. And then he's so overdone by the concept of it that he can't go back to work. He takes himself off to the drive-in and he takes himself off to bowling, and then he goes back to see her and says, yeah, okay, I'm in, you know. But for me, I didn't feel that there was enough of a pull to kind of do that. How did you feel
I think you're right. I think it's really heavily relying on that you are in the film to watch that happen, and therefore it must somehow happen. And you're right, it doesn't give us anything about who he is or why he would do such a thing. It's just, you've really just got to go with he really finds her attractive and therefore will do anything for her. Which is a very common theme, I would say, of just film noir. Often it's the beautiful woman walks into the office, gives them some spiel about a missing person or something that needs to be found. And it's like it's nearly always from the moment she walked into my office, I knew, you know, she had legs to 11 and everything. And it's really just down to, I really want to have this woman. It's very possessive, and therefore I will do anything for her. I think that's a common fault with the genre in this era. I think in later years, obviously as character and story has developed, people have found more interesting ways to really relate to them. But yeah, I agree. It's sort of just like, well, she's super attractive. I must therefore do whatever I can to be with her, even if that is murder and breaking the law and everything else.
Yeah, maybe that's why Jessica Rabbit was created, because there needed to be a caricature that was so stunningly beautiful that any man would do anything for her. Perhaps that's
and,
it. But yeah,
and it is. And they give her a really a husband who you think she shouldn't be with. You know, even he's, because he's so stupid. You're like, well, I could be a better person than. And they did. They really went over the top. Like, she is the most beautiful and the most amazing of all of these cartoon characters that you could find. You know, she's one of the few human cartoon characters.
That's it.
Well, you know.
Something you're allowed to find attractive, because you wouldn't find a bunny in the same outfit attractive, would you?
No.
Anyway, we've digressed away. I feel like Jessica Rabbit's going to come up again. But I think his decision-making, again, was really reflected when it came to the midpoint where he carried out the murder. And again, he was still very reluctant up until that point. And perhaps if they lent into that a slight... you know, he was very cocksure about himself in the sense, of course she finds me attractive. I find her attractive and that's enough, you know, and I can make her swoon and all of this. But I think if they lent into that, maybe those motivations might have been a little bit clearer. And again, because this is one of the earlier examples of film noir, perhaps this was this idea of motivation led by the femme fatale. Or whatever manipulative antagonistic force was out there is reinforced since this film came out. But as an early example, I think this is definitely highlights as a weak point.
Yeah. And I found watching a few of these that they are very story driven. They're not really character driven, these noir films. They're very much here is your character. This is the situation they are in this week. It's almost like with the serialized cinema, you know, that you sort of had. And it almost felt, it is almost coming out of that. It's like, well, you know, you've got Dan Dare escaping this. So this week you've got Walter Neff escaping this femme fatale. What would he do this week? You know, how's next week going to be for him? And it's just, here it's just like, here is your fun character, and this is the situation they're in, and there's no real character beyond that, which is a shame because history of this era, you know, it is so rich that you have so much emotional sort of baggage to draw from. Like, you know, obviously you've got the war on, you've had the depression, you know, sort of coming out of like the 20s and the 30s, and you have all this sort of richness for a character's backstory to really understand where they're coming from, and it's just a shame that they never sort of touch upon it, or really allude to anything for either of them, for anybody in this film. And it's such a shame, because I think that's what I think it would let it down to a modern audience, is that.
Yeah, I think we as a modern audience, we are almost in, as interested in the backstory. I mean, you know, you only have to look at current culture at the moment. We, on Netflix, for example, there is a prequel to Bridgerton, which is diverse, like just a tiny chink of information that was in the original books has been drawn out into a whole series. And I'm sure that won't be the end of it. And I think we're fascinated by the person behind the person, that, you know, what was our character doing? How did they become the person that they are now? And especially as stories, finding unique concepts and unique stories is getting harder and harder, looking at the backstory is I think going backwards is the way forwards. So I think more than ever that we're really conscious of what a protagonist or an antagonist backstory is. But as you mentioned about the characterization, the characterization of Walter's boss Keyes was a really, I felt, actually quite a strong character, and the relationship that they both have is very well drawn. And I feel that that's, as a writer looking at it, I would wonder whether that relationship was based on a genuine relationship, because it just felt so natural and so flowing. And I really loved the constant theme of Keyes not being able to light his own match, and Walter having to do that for him very, very coolly with his thumb. I mean, you can't get more film noir than that. But then for the very end, when Walter, you know, he can't do it himself, he falters on that, and Keyes actually steps up to be the strong one. And I feel like they have a more genuine, intimate relationship than anyone in that film does. How do you feel about Keyes and the relationship they have between each other?
I think that's the true love story, is those two.
He does declare his love, doesn't he? Twice. I love you too.
He does. Yeah, exactly. And I think there is. And I think there's they are the true love relationship within the story. And then she upheaves that between the two of them, and she makes him believe, she makes like Neff believe that Keyes is the villain, and therefore we start to believe Keyes is the villain, because even as the narration's going and he's onto them and things like this, but it's like, well, if it wasn't for her, these two guys would be off, you know, solving insurance fraud across the country, you know. But yeah, and like you said, that beautiful motif of the matches all the way through. So often those motifs come up within sort of parent children. There's always some, you know, a quiet place. You know, it's the sign language that we sort of come back to. That sort of is that emotional sort of moment between the father and daughter. Often I find it's normally in those sort of relationships, which is what I think makes it quite interesting, that that's how we're showing these two men. And it's these two men in 1944, which is also speaks to society, because a lot of these guys who are now watching that film have come back from the war, they've come back from the trenches, they have these deeper connection with the man stood next to them than they would have done, you know, say you're in your 30s, like, so you may not have been in the First World War, so you now have that same thing. So building that relationship is with that motif is such a great way to speak to the audience about the love of these two guys without being over, you know, overt about it, which is just a lovely thing for this era. And why I've actually come to appreciate this film.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
That little bit more, because it starts to showing, it starts to really reflecting the era it was coming out. And really trying to speak to an audience to say, look, you know, these guys just like you, this guy just happened to fall for the wrong gal, you know, and therefore going down. But yeah, it's a great character way to show how two people are without having to go into such heavy dialogue or overly force a relationship. Just having these little moments really sort of brings it all together, and especially the reverse at the end. So obviously you know it's Neff and doing it to Keys, Neff and Keys, Neff and Keys, Neff and Keys, and now Neff is on back and Keys does it for him.
Yeah, because it was looking a bit like it was a one-sided relationship. Keys was always quite highly strung, so to have him sort of return that match, return the favour in a way of lighting, being able to light the match, just shows that, you know, underneath it all, that really was there, all of that, that endearment, I think. And I really liked how their relationship evolved as it went along, and you did feel as an audience watching that you were threatened by Keys as his discovery. Pretty much to Walter, everyone was an antagonist in some way, shape or form at some point in the film. There was always, everyone was the antagonist, and no more of an antagonist was himself. He really did manage to ruin him everything for himself. He had everything, didn't he? He had the job offer, which was going to be great. He could have just walked away from that girl and found another one. And, you know, clearly, as he's just so adorably attractive, with all of his lovely pickup lines. So, you know, he threw it all away himself, and it was him that came up with the idea of the double indemnity, sort of making sure that if there was, somebody was going to be murdered, it needed to be in this way so we could get the most money possible. And that was a real reflection of just coming out of that sort of post-war, spiraling towards the 50s, where consumerism was massive. The value of life, of the simple pleasures of life, were, you know, actually a lot less than money. So it fell into that, what became the structure of film noir.
And I think even coming out of the 30s, where you would work up, you know, it's building the Empire State Building for like a dollar a week. I think where life, you know, was less worth than money. I think it's, you know, it's all from that, you know, and I think everybody would do something for a buck, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
You know,
everything. And I think Walter has this perfect opportunity lined up for him. And of course, it's part of the dark inversion that he needs to not recognize, not value this opportunity, and go down this terrible path that will ultimately lead to his death and misery. But he identifies before Keys does that he is the best. If anyone is going to commit a murder, it's going to be him, because he knows all of the ins and outs of all of it, because he's been doing it so long and he's so good at it. So he kind of recognises that he's got this superpower within him, that he could become this investigator. And he's got a choice. He could do evil or good with his superpower. And he decides, instead of becoming an investigator, to become the fraudster. But he makes that decision really early on that he was not going to be good. Almost, you know, because the moment that he gets the phone call from Phyllis, he's offered the job, and then he's interrupted with the phone call. But before he even gets on the phone, he's quite hesitant about whether he wants to take that job. And I just want to, like, what are your thoughts around that setup? Because it almost implies that even without Phyllis, he was going to destroy his own chance of succeeding.
I think this comes down to his character flaw. And I'll say it again, he's a schmuck. He is a schmuck. He's an idiot. And I think he just likes going around flirting with women, making money. And I think if he took the insurance job, took the investigator job, he would have to deal with more boring situations. He'd have to do paperwork. He would have to do, he'd have to speak to, like, guys and just, like, work out what happened. Where I think he wants to go around womanizing and being the sort of, you know, the cad about town and, you know, sort of be the big I am. And I think as soon as he takes that, he loses that power, and he loses his superpower to an extent, because now he's in a world with people who are on the same level as him. You know, Keyes is just as good, if not better, than him, because Keyes works it all out. He may get the wrong guy, but he works it all out. And I think as soon as he steps into that next level, he's no longer special. And I think he likes being special. And I think that's why I think that might speak into why he ends up doing the murder. I think he's doing it so he can be with her and get some money. But I think a lot of it is just to prove he could.
He could do it. And it.
But
the only thing with that is he makes a complete U-turn in the third act, and Phyllis has to blackmail him to stay the course. He then sort of goes cold on her and starts, you know, going a bit Joe Goldberg over Lola, the stepdaughter. I'm just going to challenge you with that one.
I think he actually realizes what he's done. And this is what I think it's a film really dealing with consequence. Every act, I would say, I think it's probably like a 5-act structure to this film. And every act is dealing with the consequence of what happened before. And I truly believe if he didn't think Phyllis was going to end up trying to kill him, which I think he always had in his back of his mind. I don't think he's a bad guy overall. I think he was just a man up for a bit of a challenge and a bit of a laugh, and then realized how far he went. And then when he started to realize, that's when it all started to dawn on him. And that's why, because I think that's when he meets Lola and he starts to humanize her father. And that relationship, I think that's why he gets a bit creepy. It's weird because it's not played creepy by any stretch of the imagination, and how they play it is actually he comes across as like an older brother or a more of a protective figure over the daughter. And I think he does that because he starts to see what he's done to an actual person, because all he was fed up to that point was, my husband's the worst man ever, my husband's this, my husband is that. And it's not until you see, well, actually, he was also a really loving father. And now he's like, oh no, I've murdered her father.
Yeah, he does have a moment of that. You could see two sides of a coin here. You could see it as fatherly protection, and that is provoking his, you know, attack of conscience. But there's also, I think, because of the way that he's behaved towards women leading up to that point, it does give some vibes of, yeah, I don't fancy you anymore, I like the younger model. And there is something a little bit creepy about it. But perhaps looking through a 23rd sort of, you know, it's 2023 and we're used to seeing things like Dexter and You and, you know, all of those things where where a man that behaves that way towards a woman is clearly after more than, you know, anything. So perhaps looking at it, you know, with a modern lens is giving those creepy vibes, whereas it might not have done in the early 50s. It's just a very bizarre flip. And I don't feel that there was enough in the setup to really justify how he suddenly had this attack of conscience and felt that his good heart justified him killing Phyllis and driving Zucchetti away from the murder scene and ultimately giving his confession at the end. Where do you feel that it came from, this attack of consciousness?
I would think it comes from talking with the daughter. I think that's when we're meant to believe that he has then started to see it. But again, it lacks that backstory. I mean, and I don't mean we have to have whole flashbacks and everything else, but just a line here and there, just so we can understand where he had come from, what he had been. You know, even if he was just like, you know, when he met Phyllis, you know, and she was starting, when, you know, something had happened, he goes, oh, that's like my old mum used to say. And then it was like, oh, okay, now we understand. Like his mum was a bit cold. His mum, okay, all right, we're starting to understand where he had come from. But it gives us nothing. And that's when I go back to it's like Walter Neff, you know, in this week's adventure, you know, murdering a woman's husband. And it's really that. That's it. And I think we're meant to believe it's the conversations with the daughter is where his mind and his conscience is starting to sort of be wrestled. Up until that point, I think he's under the spell of Phyllis. And then when he starts hanging out with Lola, I think also having an implied abusive boyfriend as well makes him stop and think, you know, I think we're meant to believe he's trying to protect her and realizing, even though he drops her off with the abusive boyfriend at the end, it's like, well, yeah, you have her back.
Exactly. That doesn't fit, does it? You know, that he was horrible when he met him, when he dropped Lola off, and then to find out that he's been not only having an affair with a woman, you know, while he's supposedly going out with Lola, but also was complicit in this plan to entrap him to murder the husband so they can run off together. And then he hands him back at the end and you know, to Lola back to him in the end. So that, I think it, as much as I feel that he perhaps is doing these things for Lola because of a guilty conscience around murdering her father, there's something that's not quite sitting right. I think there was maybe the ending felt a little bit rushed in that sense.
I think there definitely could have been a bit more of a, and they tried to do the revelation that Phyllis had killed her mother, and that's sort of subtly implied, and to make him again think, oh well, she's so devious, she's already murdered, and he was just like, well, she'd already alluded that she was the nurse before. So if you weren't such an idiot, you would have put it together,
yeah,
you know, 40 minutes ago, like everybody else had.
Poor Walter.
But the casting, Frederick, who played Walter, he had only done sort of light comedies before this. And I think, again, they're relying on this sort of kooky guy sort of turning up. It's like putting Ben Stiller in a film noir. Like you would only see like this kooky guy. And I think that's what they're also playing on, that the casting of this character, which again, obviously now we're, you know, 60, 70, 70, 80 years beyond the release of this film. we obviously we have no connection to these people, so we're only ever seeing it as a whole of a film.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
But so there's not enough character to actually justify what they're doing. So, but yeah, so yeah, there's no real reason, no character reason for why he's switching up near the end, except for that he might be in trouble.
Yeah,
that's saving his own skin.
And I think we, as screenwriters, modern day screenwriters, I think there's a lot that we could possibly rework with this film to sort of make it sit better with a modern audience. But it's, you know, as a film noir, as it goes, it doesn't get any more classic than this. You know, this is one of the sort of cornerstones of this genre. But how do you feel that that stands up against modern day screenwriting techniques? How do you feel that the genre has evolved since then?
Well, I think it's become far more about the PI. You know, you look at Chinatown with Jack Nicholson playing Jake. You feel for this guy. You really start to like humanize them, and you find, you know, a bit more about him, and you really get to understand these characters. And I think that's where it's gone. I think the stories, you can never get better stories than the original Noirs, but I think the characters are really lacking. In the Maltese Falcon, Sam Spade is sleeping with his partner's wife, which is revealed. And the minute the guy is dead, he's like, take his name off the door and put mine up there. Like the guy's barely cold, and he's already like scraped his name off and have it like Sam Spade PI. And so the characters are really, really cold and hard, which is probably plays into the genre to an extent, but you wouldn't do that anymore because you can't. It's hard to have that, and I dislike the save the cat moments, but it's hard to have those sort of likable moments where you, when you have a character that's like that. And I think even Walton and Neff, he doesn't really have any sort of, there's never a moment you were like, oh, he's, yeah, I really like him. I think all the way through you think, I don't know about this guy. I just don't understand. I don't really get him. And it's the same with her. And I know she's the femme fatale, you know, the villain, quote unquote. But again, there's nothing to sort of really grab onto, to really understand and really empathize with these characters.
Well, I think Phyllis actually had quite... there was more backstory for her in,
I think, come the end.
Yeah, you know, especially as, but her story was drip fed. It was drip fed through the, you know, it was quite revealing the way that she described her life when she first met Walter. I thought it was quite revealing the things that Lola had to say about her, the way that her husband interacted with her, the way that she. You know, that final scene between them unraveled, and the expression and the emotion that she had, I felt gave her a real 3D personality and a backstory, enough of a backstory to draw us in. But I agree with you, I think Walter was not at all. And the closest that it came to was his relationship with Keyes and that endearment that they shared. Not only in that professional kind of, I suppose, work husbands, if you like, as you might call them nowadays, But in just on a personal level, I think Walter wanting to confess to him, and he wanted to reassure Keyes, you were right all along, you worked it all out, it was me that set you on the wrong path, and I'm sorry, and you know, and all of this, I don't want this for you, I just want you to know the truth, and I will leave you to it, and you know, I'm sorry. So I think that was quite telling of his character, but there wasn't enough in there, like you say. And I think if we were drawing this story out now, he would be a slightly more formed version, without a doubt. So were there any other things that sort of didn't really work for you or did really work for you that you absolutely loved?
I think some of the voiceover, now obviously voiceover in film noir is a must have.
They have to classically be a reflective protagonist, don't they? So yeah, whether they're a PI or an investigator or a writer or so
more often than not does it come out that way. I would say sometimes that I felt the narration gave away too much of the I wouldn't say a surprise, because we know inevitably what will happen with these things, but it gave away that little bit too much at times. And that, you could say, well, it's all about how fate and you know is inevitable, you know, the inevitability of fate, and we know he's going to die, or he's been at least been shot, so we'll get to the end and find out how. But I found that some of the dialogue, how he was describing Phyllis's character, sort of alluded to the end before, you know, like we didn't know she had shot him earlier on. It could have been a number of things of how we got there to being shot, but it almost alludes that so early. You're like, well, she shot him, and it just felt like, oh, I wish if you were a little bit more vague,
maybe.
A little bit more vague about it, you know, like, oh, you know, it's a great sort of starting, you know, where he sort of reveals it, you know, I did it for money, and I did it for a woman, and I didn't have the money, I didn't have the woman, but we don't know anything else. And then after he meets her, he mentioned the insurance thing. For you, Keyes, that would have been a red bell, you know, an alarm. But for me, I just sort of carried on. I was just like, oh, right, well, if you hadn't sort of pointed me in that direction, like it would have been a little bit more of a reveal when it starts to come up. And you sort of already have told me what's going to happen in the next couple scenes. And I wish it had just been a little bit more vague. And a little bit more sort of about his feeling at that moment than necessarily what is to come.
Yeah. And I had that down as something that didn't really work for me either, was that storytelling, that narration. And it is very classic of the genre. And as again, to keep saying it, but this was one of the very first in this genre. So setting this structure, it's possible that it might have been slightly overdone in comparison to other film noir films, but
it was written by Raymond Chandler, who is a fantastic crime writer and noir novelist of the time. But he was working with Billy Wilder, who does a lot of comedy and did a lot of other sort of things. So I feel that's a lot of Billy Wilder trying to force that hand.
I think that is it, isn't it? Because there's 80 years has passed and it has been satired completely, this genre. And so, you know, even when you think about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, you know, it's a comedy and it has an awful lot of this narration. It really leans into it for its comedy. So to, you know, for someone, my introduction to film noir, if I think back far enough, was probably through something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So that probably wasn't the best way of showing me, you know, what an amazing film noir structure looks like, but has set it up in such a way that now I find it difficult to sort of really believe, like you say, that form of storytelling. And it kind of almost feels a bit of a hangover from radio drama, where that kind of narration is necessary, and maybe even sort of narrative, long form storytelling like a novel, like a crime novel. You would rely on that narration because there isn't the visual cues. So, I mean, I guess it has its place in this genre, but and can work outside of the genre in the right way. But I think it would be really difficult to write a film, a serious film, like a serious crime thriller with this narration nowadays. It did take out some of the magic and the suspense, I think, for me.
I think if people do it now, it's more bookends. I think that they often do it an introduction at the beginning, and then a sort of rounding off at the end. And I think that's normally how people do it. I think even with American Beauty, that has narration, and I it's only at the beginning, I believe, at the end.
Well, I think something like that is successful because it's more breaking the fourth wall, isn't it? And I think that's a different type of narration. That's your protagonist letting you into their head. Whereas in this case, in most film noirs, they're documenting something, aren't they? They are.
It's
a reflection of their process.
Yeah. I mean, The Batman, the new one, which I think is a... which is a great, I think that's a really sort of new take on it's a really sort of interesting take on the noir tale within that world. That starts off with talking about like the streets and how the world has gone to down and things like that. And it establishes our world, and then it ties it off at the end. And I feel like if you're going to do a noir now, you need to set us into the world with that narration and then tie us off at the end and not give us beat for beat all the way through.
Well, I think that's a fantastic takeaway. So thank you so much for this incredibly stimulating discussion, Alex. Big question though, does it deserve to go in the script department vaults for all time?
Well, that is a question. Now, part of me would love to say yes, because of just what it did and how it changed a lot of settings. But for characterization, I would say no. But for story and what it did for that genre at that time, I would say yes. But I would say no for characters, because it really lacks.
I think I would agree with you. And I think if I was going to put it in, it would be because I think Phyllis is quite well formed, and I found a lot to relate to her as somebody 80 years on, but I don't think that's quite enough. I think the sort of that narration was at times a bit lazy, and I felt that in particular Walter's motivations just weren't defined enough, and again the relationships, the characterization and the relationships that were affected by it, I found it really difficult to believe some of his actions. It didn't feel that he was as manipulated as he should have been. He just, I'm going to do this. And it just didn't feel quite as polished as it could be. But it really was a brilliant film as an introduction into film noir, and sort of taking a look back at one of the earlier films in our history. I think it was a really valuable thing to watch. So if you are listening to this and you haven't watched it, then please go and watch it, because it's very good as you've all the discussion points we've picked up today of ways to look at the genre in a different way. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Alex, and I look forward to doing another review with you soon. And of course, if anyone listening hasn't subscribed, then please do, so that you don't miss out on our next discussion. And of course, do like and share this. Join us over on the Script Department. Our network of screenwriters are just beavering away. You can find out what we're up to. But we'll see you again soon.